The combination of aging baby boomers and the Affordable Care Act is leading to medical mega mergers. What's special about Banner teaming up with the University of Arizona?
What Banner brings is really a very multifaceted system into the environment, one that really looks like and smells like and is an academic health center.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Nick Blumberg. Today on the show, the impact on the business of healthcare. 1 year ago, 19 firefighters died fighting the Yarnell Hill fire. How's the community doing? And medical marijuana use is forcing changes in your HR office.
A lot of people who take medicinal marijuana have long-term health issues. And as long as it doesn't impair their job, I think employers are going to have to allow that.
Fireworks are sparking safety concerns across the valley, and we'll sample a Southwestern twist on a fast food favorite.
The show is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Nick Blumberg. Valley weather, not big changes coming our way for this weekend. Expect sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday with highs of about 107 or 108. But by the middle of next week, might want to start to worry a bit. Could get up to 112. Currently, it's sunny and 100 degrees.
The San Juan fire continues to grow near the small community of Vernon between Springerville and Sholo in the White Mountains. The fire was first reported midday yesterday at about 100 acres, but it quickly jumped to 1,000 by the evening. Fire officials now estimate the blaze has consumed between 12 and 1,500 acres, though they haven't been able to get a firm number since the plumes of smoke are preventing a flyover.
Some area residents have received mandatory evacuation orders. Mike Brady lives in Vernon and is standing by to evacuate. His home is about 2 miles away from the flames. Brady's seen the damage from the Wallow and Rodeo Chenisky wildfires that burned near his neighborhood a few years ago.
We can stand right here on our driveway and just see it burning over the ridge, coming down the mountains. So if they do not get this stopped and all of this burns, the White Mountains basically have burned and it will all be gone.
Very windy conditions have contributed to the fire's rapid growth. The National Weather Service in Flagstaff says gusts came close to 40 miles an hour yesterday afternoon and that they only died down for a few hours overnight. Meteorologist Ben Peterson says this will likely be the last windy day in the area for a while, but things will still be
very dry through at least Tuesday and starting Sunday, but especially Monday and Tuesday, it'll be getting quite hot. Temperatures in that area will be rising to the 80s and into the lower 90s by Monday and Tuesday.
Peterson says the wind's currently gusting up near 30 miles an hour, and he warns that dangerous storms could be moving into the area next week.
One thing we're going to have to watch for is thunderstorms that are very high in the air with lots of dry air underneath them that can produce very gusty winds, downbursts, and dry lightning. Lightning starts that don't get put out by rain, things like that. So that'll be a concern 5 or 6 days from now.
And as crews work the San Juan fire, the thoughts of many Arizonans are turning to a place a couple hundred miles to the west where a crew of hotshots died after the weather took a turn.
The day began with about a dozen reporters standing at a roadblock. They were hoping to get a close-up look at the fire. In the distance, planes dropped flame retardant on Yarnell Hill. The outgoing fire boss, Roy Hall, spoke to the group.
Good morning. It's been a long night. As we face the day, the highest priority is for the fallen comrades. Once that mission has been taken care of, we'll go on with the firefight. It's a long ways from being over.
That was 1 year ago, after 19 Granite Mountain hotshots had died in the Yarnell Hill fire. KJZZ's Laura Morales was there and joins me now to update us on the condition of the town of Yarnell and its residents.
They've begun to rebuild. The Yarnell Hill Recovery Group has helped rebuild 9 homes for the uninsured and helped underinsured residents get back on their feet. There have been 42 building permits for new homes. That represents only 33% of the homes that actually burned. 50 property owners in Yarnell have filed lawsuits, about 50, totaling more than $185 million in damages. They're rebuilding, but it's definitely a different town than it was a year ago.
People have mixed feelings about how much they want to be reminded of these things because they're reminded of losing a loved one every day anyway. Did you hear contrary reactions to people who don't really even want to remember this anymore?
There have been several outbursts in the community at different forums where people have said, enough already, let's move on. David Turbyfill, the father of one of the hotshots who died, says he's heard people in the community express sort of their frustration, or they're just sort of overwhelmed with the memorials and the fundraisers, and they want to move on. But as he said, this was a significant event in history for not only their town, but for the region and maybe even the country. So it's going to take some time.
And what I think that they're kind of missing is that this was our D-Day. This was our 9/11. I mean, this is significant to at least the region, especially the community, as those other events that are there. It's a historical marker in time.
And losing so many of their brethren as they did nearly a year ago, how's the firefighting community doing a year later?
They're at different stages of grief. Wade Ward, the public information officer for the Prescott Fire Department, says he's been in operation mode ever since it happened a year ago. So he hasn't really had time to process it completely.
You know, other than the fact that we're hurt, tired, and confused at times, we are still here doing our jobs. Every day we get on the truck and answer the call just like we did before June 30th, just like the guys would want us to.
We know fire season obviously is an annual occurrence in Arizona, elsewhere in the West. What are you seeing as far as conditions right now in northern Arizona, as far as the concern about the continuing fire season?
Well, the winds have finally died down today. I did see in the forecast that we're due for some thunderstorms or a slight chance of thunderstorms next week, which usually means we'll see dry lightning ahead of actual moisture. So fire crews are definitely on alert. In Oak Creek Canyon, they're preparing for the monsoons, which will probably start by July 7th. They usually do. That means not only the potential, but they're really saying the threat of mudslides and rock slides, and people should be prepared to leave.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales in northern Arizona. The story of the Granite Mountain hotshots who died in the Yarnell Hill fire will be told in a feature film currently in pre-production. Another healthcare merger in Arizona is moving forward now that the State Board of Regents has given its blessing for negotiations between Banner Health and the University of Arizona Health Network to proceed. It's a change of pace from last year's affiliation between Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln Health Network. Eugene Schneller, professor at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and co-director of the Health Sector Supply Chain Research Consortium, says the biggest difference is the presence of a university health center.
Banner has for many years had many of the attributions of a major academic health center, but it's never had the very strong relationship with an actual university hospital and with the medical school and residency programs that come with that kind of an environment.
So, Gene, this sounds like a logical fit to you then?
Well, whether it's not it's logical is an interesting question.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, I think it's the kind of progression that we're seeing. And what we find is that academic health centers like the University of Arizona find that in an environment where one needs accountable care organizations, one needs large networks of patients, that having the academic health center focus is not enough. And therefore, what Banner brings is really a very multifaceted system into the environment, one that really looks like and smells like and is an academic health center. What we really see here is a governance system, and I've had a chance to look over the plans that Banner and the University of Arizona developed collaboratively to develop a shared governance system, not just to bring the two systems together, but to really assure a very high quality, stable level of medical education within the state. And I think that's a huge advantage for the state of Arizona.
How difficult can combining cultures be, and how much consideration does that usually get when health systems collaborate?
Well, it's very difficult. We've seen other mergers of academic health centers with other entities. One that comes to mind is Tulane, and Tulane basically was bought by HCA, which is the large investor-owned healthcare system. And Tulane has worked very hard to maintain all the characteristics of a high-quality academic health center, and to be able to make decisions that one would hope an academic health center would make that might be a little different than the decisions that a community system would make. In the early years of that, there was some lack of match of the cultures, and it took, I think, a good deal of time for HCA to understand what it really meant to manage with and within an academic environment. And I think we've seen the same thing in Georgetown, which went through a similar kind of merger with an investor-owned system. I think what's somewhat different here is Banner isn't an investor-owned system. What we see in the agreement with the University of Arizona is a commitment to invest significant resources into the medical education side of this combination.
Considering how during the recession, the healthcare industry is one that we kept hearing wasn't suffering as much or was in fact maybe growing during that time, what sort of effect could mergers, mega mergers like this have on the state's economy?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think what we saw in some of the new services was announcement of a reduction in GDP, and much of that being attributed to healthcare and the healthcare environment not expanding as quickly as some had hoped. We've also seen some layoffs in the system, not necessarily attributed to mergers and acquisitions, but attributed to the relatively thin margins that hospitals have had. We know that university health system has had difficulty in the last year financially. One would hope that the efficiencies here wouldn't lead to the loss of jobs, but really higher productivity within the system. And I think Banner brings to the table some excellence in being able to manage a multifaceted system, something that many academic health centers really haven't developed the expertise to do.
Eugene Schneller, professor at ASU's W.P. Carey School and co-director of the Health Sector Supply Chain Research Consortium. Banner and the U of A Health Network are hoping to finalize their deal by September.
Coming up on the show, adorable baby birdies.
Oh my God, it's so cute. These are predators. These are mean killing machines. It's not cute.
Even vicious predators need health care. We'll find out where they get it. That's ahead on the show. Good afternoon. It's 2:16. Checking Valley traffic. No major accidents right now, but on the westbound I-10 approaching the 51 mini stack, there's about a mile and a half of fairly heavy slowing.
And Nick, you know, it's the end of June, which means we're going to have a hot weekend.
Oh,
big
what
surprise
a shock.
There. So high temperatures on both Saturday and Sunday around 107. Look for those highs to reach 112 by the middle of next week. Currently sunny and 100 degrees.
Do you spend much time in the car right now? If you do, they're impossible to miss. Huddled on the side of the road, baking in the summer sun, they're bright and flashy, begging for your attention, trying to draw your eyes away from their neighbors. I'm standing on McClintock Drive, just south of the 202. There's about a dozen of them on the side of the road. I see Hugh Hallman, David Shapira, Andrew Walter, candidates for Justice of the Peace or City Council. That's right, we're talking about campaign signs. During an election year, just about everybody you ask can name spots like this where political signs are clustered. I wanted to learn more about the strategy behind campaign signs, and as it turns out, this is something a member of Arizona's congressional delegation knows a lot about. David Schweikert represents District 6, and he's been wrangling with political signage for decades.
My very first campaign was out putting up signs for Herb Drinkwater.
But the signs Schweikert's camp puts up these days are a lot different than the signs he used to haul around Scottsdale.
In the old days, they used to be plywood with wallpaper paste and paper on them. And so you'd hit monsoon season trying to put them up, and they would. I've been knocked cold putting up one of those big signs. And you can really tell those folks who've loved this and been doing it a long time, they'll stand in the street and look at angles of degrees on how a car can see it and how the headlights will hit it. And is there someone else's sign in the way? Even though you and I may accept the reality that people are driving, you know, 50 miles an hour by it, and it's just a flash on the side of their vision. But for the folks involved in politics, the signs really are sort of a labor of love.
And as for why you see the big clusters of signs all around the valley, Schweikert says there's a kind of first-in effect.
first person to put up a sign in a spot, others show up because they assume, well, this is a good spot because the owner's going to allow it to stay. And it gets funnier than that. If you've ever had the chance to sit down with a number of folks who like working on campaigns, they'll have entire discussions on the proper way to wire a sign to the T-post. So it really does get that absurd.
The big signs, he says, do a couple things. They create greater name ID, and they also show people who follow politics closely that a candidate is viable and taking the race seriously. As for individual yard signs, Schweikert says those are the product of door-to-door outreach and that some of the numbers his campaign ran last cycle showed the yard signs could have a huge effect on how a district votes. And that points to the impact this kind of campaigning can have as TV and radio ads become less impactful in the social media age where everyone's fighting for eyeballs.
All of a sudden now, mail, yard signs, larger street signs are actually sort of coming back into vogue as a way to communicate with so many folks who've now sort of found alternative ways, and those alternative media they listen to locks them out from being communicated to by a candidate.
Schweikert says he actually enjoys going out and putting up campaign signs himself.
My hands right now have all these puncher marks from the wire. You'll sit around with first-time candidates and long-time candidates, and we'll tell the same stories about what it's like putting up a sign in the middle of the night and having the police pull up alongside you with a spotlight. I mean, it's just part of the tradition.
Nothing to see here, member of Congress.
Oh, and I get razzed so much when people pull up and say, you're putting up your own signs? You're really that cheap?
Republican David Schweikert represents Arizona's 6th Congressional District. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Nick Blumberg.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. It was a radical act of nationalist terrorism carried out in Sarajevo 100 years ago tomorrow. Serbian gunmen set off a chain reaction that kills the heir of the Habsburg Empire, draws in first the region of Eastern Europe and then Russia, facing off against the new United Germany, then the French throw in with Russia, and then Britain. And so begins World War I.
The war that would end all wars quite literally created the maps that would end all peace in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Global Post co-founder Charles Sennett has just launched a new series called The 11th Hour, Unlearned Lessons of World War I. His series is all about the boundaries that are under pressure from Crimea to Moldova to Iraq and Syria, all ethnic and political conflicts that ended with no armistice, resolved with no treaty.
The reason we chose the 11th hour is because we wanted the series to have some urgency, a sense that World War I matters right now. And while I've been reporting this series, you know, I've been out across the Balkans and in Nigeria. We're planning a trip to Iraq and looking at the way contemporary conflicts are unfolding and really taking shape along the lines that were created by the maps drawn during and in the immediate aftermath of World War I is amazing. I mean, these maps are now being erased. When you see ISIS openly talking about wanting to erase that history, to cross those lines and to create a new map of the Middle East, the Kurds are saying the same thing in a different language and in a much nicer diplomatic way. But they're also saying, we're going to reclaim what we think of as Kurdistan with our capital of Kirkuk in northern what is today Iraq. And this is dramatically unfolding not only there, but you can also see this in Nigeria, very much fueling the ideology of Boko Haram is the notion that Western colonialism and its education is blasphemous. I mean, that's what Boko Haram means. Boko, Western colonial education, Haram, blasphemy. So the arrogance of the drawing of the maps 100 years ago on this anniversary of World War I is very much alive and burning in so many of the conflicts we cover every day right now.
And we could talk about North Somalia and South Somalia. We could talk about North Sudan and the brand new nation of South Sudan as being a representation of all of this. The chaos of the Horn of Africa is basically a consequence of the First World War and then the chaos that happened during the Cold War, which was an attempt to maintain these territories in a kind of Cold War deep freeze. And when it all fell apart, we've seen the result for the last 20 years.
That's right. There's an amazing book by Christopher Clark called Sleepwalkers. I think you've talked about it on your show.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable book.
It's an amazing history which tries to make the comparison that we are living in a moment, a historical moment, that is very similar to the days leading up to World War I, in that we have a multipolar world in which there are rising and declining empires, and that creates great uncertainty. And seemingly small events can just erupt into world conflagrations or regional conflagrations. And I think that's the context in which a lot of people are looking at Iraq, and it's why everyone is so worried, that really does open the possibility of a Sunni-Shia divide opening up into a regional war. And I think this is why what's happening is horrifying if you know the region well, because if those lines come undone, if the maps of the Middle East are going to be redrawn, we're going to see that theme resonate really across all of the Middle East. And I think it's powerful.
And we have to look unflinchingly at the largeness of the history, because it's bigger than the Middle East. I mean, I remember when I was in Kurdistan at the end of the first Gulf War, people talked about Sykes-Picot and how Clemenceau, the French, sold out the Kurds in 1923. And that was the beginning of all of this sort of thing. But you know, you could also see these maps have been rewritten for decades now. If you look in the Congo, in Zaire, the Belgian Empire is gone. And if you're going to think about what vanished that no one imagined ever being able to vanish in World War I, you've got the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which certainly the authors of the time never believed would just vanish overnight. The Ottomans were sort of on their last legs. But the idea that the U.S. will continue like this forever is perhaps the most dubious assumption if we think back to what changed 100 years ago. And it's all this idea of what we think is permanent and what turns out to be, poof, ephemeral, that really that 100 years was all about, and what makes it so scary to look back on today.
That's right. I mean, that is the question that is resonant right now. If you really want to study history, it's that the United States is in a moment where its rhetoric is disconnected from the way we really carry ourselves in the world. We talk about democracy, but did we really stand up for it in the Arab Spring? We talk about these grand issues that inform the narrative of our country, but to the world, we're not living up to them. And I think that was one of the most convincing arguments that Christopher Clark made in this book, Sleepwalkers, is that empires can decline, and they can decline rapidly. That can create a time of great uncertainty. And I think Clark was right on the money. I think we're living in a moment where there is a lot at play. And, you know, as we've been saying, it's really time to dust off the history books.
Charles Sennett, co-founder of Global Post, and heading up the Ground Truth Project based at WGBH, our partner in Boston. Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. You're listening to the show at 227.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Public Library Foundation, inviting kids, teens, and adults to sign up for the summer reading game now through July 26th. Details, reading log, and online game at phoenixpubliclibrary.org.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city. Today, from the circus.
Got here, there was a part where they had fire and they were throwing it around and like passing each other, and it was cool. I like how they did it. They'd be doing a flip and they would land through the hoop and then they would do another flip. So like they'd be doing a whole bunch of flips and then jump through a hoop. There was elephants going around, sitting down and like rolling over with people on top of them and stuff. My favorite part was when the guys on horses went around in circles when they were standing on all of them.
That's Cameron Watson with his parents at the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus in Phoenix. If you have suggestions for a future Sounds of the City, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Coming up on the show, a fast food favorite gets some Southwest flavor.
Who would have thought French fries in a Mexican taco shop would be as popular as they are? For our 5 locations, we actually use over 10,000 pounds of French fries a week. It's crazy.
Get your taste buds ready. It's the show.
You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Quick check of the freeway. Still no accidents to tell you about at this hour, but we do show on the westbound I-10. There's a slowing, pretty heavy slowing, for a couple miles on either side of the mini stack with the 51.
Clear skies expected for tonight with lows around 80, then sunny and, yes, hot this weekend with highs both Saturday and Sunday of 107. It's currently 100 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ loves cars, boats, trucks, anything with wheels and an engine. If you have an old one of those you no longer need, turn it into favorite shows here on KJZZ. It's easy. To donate a vehicle, go to cars.kjzz.org, and thanks.
We are exactly 1 week away from the 4th of July, when the sky will light up with fireworks. Sam Morgan works at Red Hot Fireworks in Phoenix. He says some family favorites are selling well.
Everything you see, you know, here, like things like Bigger Than Life and Snake Chaser and all these weird names are all fountains that create a pretty magnificent light show, and they're all ground-based. And that is some form of a fountain is our most popular firework.
But even though some fireworks can be used legally in the Valley, there are restrictions. Morgan says that doesn't keep people from asking for the illegal ones.
A lot of people come in and ask for things like Roman candles or bottle rockets, things like that.
Fireworks laws in Arizona have changed. As of June 24th, if you're in Maricopa County, you can buy and use fireworks through July 6th. Brian Scholl is a City of Phoenix fire inspector. He says that's a new development.
Last year, you could buy fireworks in Phoenix, so you couldn't actually use them in Phoenix. This year's law is equal across the board. No matter what city in Maricopa County, the permissible fireworks, which are your ground spinners, your fountains, those type items, are permissible in any city in Maricopa County.
Are firefighters a little bit on edge, a little bit cautious because they're not sure if people are going to use them correctly?
We're a little cautious, especially in the city of Phoenix. I can't remember when we've actually had fireworks that were legal in the city of Phoenix, so this is something totally new for us. We're a little bit cautious to see how people use the fireworks. That's why we keep on telling people, if you're going to use the permissible fireworks, you know, have adult supervision, have a water supply and do it in an area like concrete or something like that where you don't have any combustible around you. But we've already had at least one fire caused by fireworks already this month.
And now, was that before the 24th?
That was before the 24th. It was a sparkler, which is a novelty item, and those are legal year-round. And a young boy was playing with sparklers, caught some leaves on fire, got into the house, and it caused a lot of damage to his house. Luckily, no one was hurt.
Is there planning that goes into it, thinking, maybe projecting how many and what resources are going to have to be used where?
We're not going to change how we get dispatched. We are going to have more fire inspectors available. If for some reason you go to a store and you see them selling like bottle rockets or firecrackers, which are not legal at any time, we'll go out there and check it out. And the police department is going to go out there if you see your neighbors shooting off firecrackers or bottle rockets. But our main goal is to educate.
How does the department handle personnel for a big City of Phoenix fireworks show?
So we have at least one fire truck, if not two, at every show. We have a fire inspector at every show to make sure that it's going off correctly. The bigger shows, we have obviously a lot more people. You know, the Phoenix Fabulous 4th, which is the big one for the City of Phoenix, at Fielding School Park, we'll have two or three engines just standing by just in case, and we'll have fire inspectors making sure that the show is going correctly.
Are you a fireworks guy? Do you like fireworks? Do a lot of the guys in the department like fireworks?
I am not a fireworks guy. I've seen too many things bad happen when you don't use fireworks correctly, so I'm not a fireworks guy. I work the fireworks shows just to make sure they go safely and everybody goes home at the end of the day.
City of Phoenix Fire Inspector Brian Scholl. U.S. Senators Rand Paul and Cory Booker last week co-sponsored an amendment already passed by the House that would ban the federal government from going after state medical marijuana programs. Arizona is one of about two dozen states that have legalized medical marijuana.
Plus, Colorado and Washington now have legal recreational marijuana for adults. Things are changing, so how do companies with drug testing policies respond? Deborah Carey with the Society for Human Resource Management says her colleagues follow developments like these very closely.
That is our job, to try to help our companies stay on the right side of the law and do the right thing.
Whether it's in terms of pre-employment or whether it's testing for employees who you think are impaired at the moment, what are the factors that companies consider when they decide whether drug testing is a policy they want to have in place?
I think they think about their own workforce. What kind of a place is it? Is it a place where there's life and death involved? Are these people are not sober? Someone's going to die, like firemen, you know, then they're going to have drug testing in place. If you're a knowledge-based company that writes reports and never sees the public and you all work in cubicles and you don't have a problem with people being impaired that you know of, I think they'd be a lot less likely to institute a drug testing policy, because it's fairly, you know, intrusive on their employees and their employees' privacy. And if it isn't necessary, they don't want to antagonize their workforce.
Do you think there might be an instance where a company who in the past didn't have a drug testing policy in place might consider enacting drug testing if they were in a state where recreational marijuana became legal? Because, you know, in the past they thought, okay, there's a legal prohibition to this, we don't need to worry about drug testing, but now that there isn't, they might want to put that in place.
That's possible, but I think there are other reasons why companies have drug testing policies or don't have them. I think it's situational, depending on the population that you have, your employees, what they do, what sort of workplace it is, and certainly it depends on what the law is in your state. I would expect that most companies that have a drug testing policy would keep it. But, for example, you might have a drug and alcohol testing policy. And I would say that marijuana legalized is very much like alcohol, which is legal to use. Anyone can use alcohol to whatever degree they wish in their own free time. But at work, of course, that's frowned upon. And people have policies that say you can't be at work while you're impaired. And I would expect that to continue with marijuana as well.
When you look at employees who may be using medical marijuana to treat certain conditions, you know, if you are a company that has, you know, an HR policy that prohibits marijuana use, you know, how do you walk the line between enforcing that policy while respecting your employees' medical choices? And are there, you know, are there sticky legal questions there where if you prohibit your employees from using marijuana, but somebody has the legal right to use it for medicinal purposes, you know, how does an employer balance that?
That is going to be a sticky legal wicket, because you'll run into the Americans with Disability Act here at some point, I am sure. From what I've read, a lot of people who take medicinal marijuana have long-term health issues. And as long as it doesn't impair their job, I think employers are going to have to allow that, because it's medicine.
Deborah Carey is Vice President of Human Resources at the Society for Human Resource Management.
Our colleague Stina Sieg. Hi, Stina.
Hello.
Recently discovered something surprising in her urban neighborhood, a small bird hopping around unable to fly.
Yeah, I had no idea what to do about it. So I looked up bird rehab on the internet, and eventually I found my way to Jody.
Jody runs a bird rehab facility out of her home, something that's not that common, but that serves a huge need here in the Valley.
Jody Kieran can trace her bird rehab career back to one moment nearly 20 years ago. The mother of six had recently released a curved-bill thrasher into the wild. It was the first bird she had ever nursed back to health. Then, an organization that she had contacted for advice asked her if she could help with a few more birds.
And I said yes.
She still can't totally say why. These days, she doesn't know how many are living in and out of her home in North Peoria.
Yes, they are kind of everywhere.
Kieran's sitting at her kitchen table, which is sort of the focal point for Fallen Feathers. It's a nonprofit bird rehab facility, which is licensed and well-known in the community, but still incredibly intimate in scale. Sometimes, Kieran will be doing surgery a few feet from where she's sitting now, or quarantining sick birds in her bathroom. She estimates she takes in 1,000 birds every year. It's as big a job as it sounds.
From sunup to sundown, we need to be putting something in one end and taking care of something that comes out the other end.
Like this baby lovebird being fed with a syringe by a volunteer just a few feet away. Baby birds need to be fed every 15 to 20 minutes during the day. Kieran knows that takes a special person. And besides,
not everybody wants to have frozen mice in their freezer.
But that's what happens when you take in all kinds of birds. Fallen Feathers is a rare breed in the rescue world. Many organizations specialize in one species, or just focus on wild birds or exotic birds. Kieran says many won't take invasive species like pigeons or starlings.
But it's a living thing, and that's what we base it on. If it's a living thing and it needs help, we're going to help it. End of story.
This anti-discrimination policy can actually be controversial in the rehab world, but Fallen Feathers is all about fiercely defending birds. Assistant Director Kay Offield says that yes, they do carry diseases, but many of them can only be spread to the same or similar species. And besides, Offield says,
everybody poops. People poop, birds poop, dogs poop, everybody poops, you clean it up, you're okay.
Fallen Feathers is on more than an acre, but it can feel tight with so many feathered guests. Outside, a group of quail scurry around a cage. A raven looks down from its perch in another, and an emu named Kevin lounges in his pen. Kieran points out a baby owl, his legs covered in downy white feathers. He has tiny horns, just barely sprouting above his intense eyes.
Oh my God, it's so cute.
These are predators. These are mean killing machines. It's not cute.
Kieran says it can be hard, but she never lets herself forget that these are wild animals. She says it's her job to help them be what they're meant to be. But of course she gets attached, she says, and she's not the only one. Brian Shea was 16 when he first came here, 4 years ago.
I'm here with Jack.
Jack's a one-eyed hawk.
He's very sweet.
Shay was the one who cut up mice for Jack and cleaned out his cage. Then he went to college. Shay is one of about 100 volunteers who are dedicated but who come and go as they can at Fallen Feathers. Kieran says her organization is just always getting by, somehow.
That's kind of the way we work it, is we find it. We make it work.
And they have to, Kieran says. It's not like there's a humane society for birds. She says she would love a large facility with regular staff and steady donations. But for now, she's got her backyard. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Peoria.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody.
It's time to head to another of the valley's hot corners, places with a lot going on. But before we leave, let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
And where are we today?
We are sitting on the patio at America's Taco Shop on 7th Street, just north of McDowell.
Fortunately, in the shade.
This is kind of the Coronado neighborhood, and 7th Street is really the, I guess, the western border of that. And from McDowell all the way up to Thomas is really the stretch that we're talking about today, although there are two new restaurants that opened up a little bit north of there.
So what are some of the highlights for you in this neighborhood?
Well, we're sitting at one. America's Taco Shop is amazing carne asada. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the street, and it's very walkable, although it is a busy street, 7th Street, you can see the cars going back, but it's quite walkable. But there's like a little row of these bungalow houses, and that's what America's Taco Shop is in, like California style, built in probably the 20s maybe, I would guess, 30s.
Certainly older looking buildings.
Yeah, but they have such a charm to them. them. And I really like that. So we've got America's Taco right here. And then just a little bit north is, it used to be Coronado Cafe. And now Michael O'Dowd, who was the chef at Kai, bought it and has turned it into Urban Vine.
You mentioned there are a couple of restaurants that open just a little bit further north of this particular area. What are those?
So Thomas is the border of this Coronado neighborhood, but just go up a little bit further to Osborne, and there's a place called Gadzooks. It's enchiladas and soup. It was opened by a 25-year-old a couple years ago in 2012. And then catty corner across the street from him is Taco Guild. And that is built in an old Methodist church. The structure is so amazing. It still has the stained glass windows. It looks like the church from the outside and also on the inside.
Does it help to sort of create a neighborhood feel when you have buildings that don't just look like sort of pad restaurants? You have bungalows, you have an old church, things like that.
Well, I do think they took advantage of that here on this little strip here. There's so many little old houses, and I don't know, what, 10 years ago, it was just kind of light looking. So now it looks like it's got character, and it's charming to walk up and down and see these old houses turned into restaurants.
So as you mentioned, 7th Street's a pretty busy street, obviously, a main thoroughfare in Phoenix. Who is coming to these restaurants? Who's eating here?
Well, I think there's a mix of people, but, you know, right behind us to the east is that whole Coronado neighborhood, which is filled with families and young professionals. I think they're walking here, and I think, well, people like me, foodies, I'll drive anywhere for good food, right? And I will definitely, there's so many places along this strip right here that are really tasty. There's Rice Paper, which is Vietnamese, and also in an old bungalow up there. There's the Main Ingredient.
For how long has this been sort of a hot corner in your mind?
Let's see. I really think, well, the Main Ingredient used to be called Lisa G's, and she opened in 2006. And I think she probably started the revolution here. But again, America's Taco Shop probably opened in 2008. So right at the end of 2008 is when things started picking up here a little bit, and it's just kind of continued on. Slowly.
So right around the time the economy crashed.
Right, yeah. It's always good to open a restaurant when the economy
Timing
crashes.
Is everything, right?
That's right. I know. But you know what? When you open a restaurant that's got great food, it doesn't matter, you know? And well, again, it's at the price point, right?
Well, so are the other restaurants at similar price points? I mean, America's Taco Shop is not overly expensive. I mean, are the other restaurants on this strip kind of the same price?
I would say they're affordable. Yes, they're all affordable. A little bit, maybe a little higher at a couple of them, but in general, no, they're at that very reasonable price point where a whole family of four could eat here for, you know, less than $50.
And I would imagine in a neighborhood, that's got to be important, right? You have
it
to be
is.
Able to have people who live in your
right.
neighborhood afford to eat at your restaurant.
Exactly.
Would you imagine that there will be more restaurants opening in this neighborhood?
Well, I do. I think there's, if you drive up and down or walk up and down, you can see that there are still some empty pockets, and maybe some people are looking at them or thinking that, hey, I could turn that in and live off that synergy that happens when you put restaurant after restaurant after restaurant.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met on 7th Street just north of McDowell in Phoenix.
There are just some foods that when you try them for the first time, it kind of feels like your whole life has been leading up to that moment. At least that's how it felt the first time I ate carne asada fries. I'd never even heard of carne asada fries until I moved to Arizona. It's often a late night order, like a giant slice or some greasy Chinese takeout. With a few variations, most plates are a mound of French fries topped with carne asada, guacamole, cheese, and sour cream, with a side of hot sauce. In the course of reporting this hard-hitting news story, I went and picked up an order of the fries, which I discussed and ate with our senior producer, Sarah Ventry.
As you see here, it's important that the guacamole and the sour cream are on different ends of the container, so
yes.
you can control the distribution,
exactly.
Which is pretty, I think, key to the consumption of carne asada fries.
We even dared the healthiest eater in the KJZZ newsroom, Steve Goldstein, to take a break from his usual afternoon fruits and veggies to try a couple bites.
Mm. That's very tasty. I can see that being addictive. Yeah. Now let me get some more of the sour cream in there.
Were you apprehensive going into this?
I was apprehensive because my co-host decided to build it up into something that would scare me.
Yeah.
But
You're an adventurous person.
No, I'm not at all. But
San Diego usually gets the credit for inventing carne asada fries. To learn more, I talked with Joaquin Farfan Jr. His family has been running taco shops in San Diego for decades. The chain Farfan's parents started is called Lolita's.
We feel strongly that we were, if not the first, one of the first to introduce these types of plates out here in San Diego.
Interestingly enough, Farfan says they actually got the idea to add French fries to the mix from their tortilla distributor, who knew of a taco shop in Arizona doing just that. Lolita's first added fries to a burrito and then rolled out a plate of carne asada fries in the late 90s. Farfan says they caught on fast.
Who would have thought French fries in a Mexican taco shop would be as popular as they are? You know, we never thought that. For our 5 locations, we actually used over 10,000 pounds of French fries a week. It's crazy.
San Diego food writer Erin Jackson says when she was introduced to carne asada fries,
it was like this unexpected moment that changed my life forever.
I feel that. Now, some people compare carne asada fries to poutine, a Canadian dish made up of fries covered in gravy and cheese curds. Jackson, who actually hails from the Great White North, says that comparison only goes so far.
People tend to be consuming carne asada fries after several beers or late at night, which is kind of a similar thing with poutine. I don't really think that's a fair comparison, other than just in terms of calories and when you're making the decision to eat the dish.
And speaking, begrudgingly, of calories.
It's 2,000 calories, so that's like a whole day's worth of calories, and then 2 days worth of fat.
Nutritionist Amy Hall says if she were advising someone with high cholesterol or blood pressure, she'd tell them to lay off the carne asada fries.
But for anyone else, I guess if you just had it once in a while, it wouldn't be too bad.
Even better if you split it with two or three other people.
It does have a lot of protein in it, so that's good.
While it's not the pinnacle of healthy eating, there's just something irresistible about the lure of this Southwestern specialty. Joaquin Farfan Jr.
In the beginning, when it was introduced, it was just the young kids. But now you have parents, grandparents, everyone into the French fry craze now.
And Steve, if you want to get some more carne asada fries, my favorite spot is Filiberto's. But if you ask Sarah Ventry, you should try Rivas in Tempe. We'll let you be the judge, or you can make a suggestion of your own by emailing us, theshow@kjzz.org.
Many Arizona pioneers are buried together in a unique cemetery in downtown Phoenix. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more.
On the corner of Jefferson and 15th Avenue, in between modern-day government buildings, sits Pioneer and Military Memorial Park. Did you know this cemetery is the final resting place of thousands of Arizona pioneers?
These are people that had influence all over the state of Arizona, and their final resting place ended up here in Phoenix.
Frank Barrios is with the Pioneer Cemetery Association, the group that oversees and protects the history and the remains of early Arizona cemeteries.
Unbelievably important historical cemetery that most people don't even realize is here.
The cemetery was originally located around Madison Street and what today is 7th Avenue. Barrio says residents back then didn't want the town's burial ground so close to the outskirts of its growing community. So around 1884, this became the burial area for the town's people.
I'll take you to a couple of the more important sites.
The city purchased one cemetery. Another was privately owned, which included a military section for veterans. Several organizations also acquired land for their members. Ultimately, there were seven cemeteries. It was referred to as Block 32 at the time. By 1914, the cemetery was abandoned and closed. The city of Phoenix took it over in the 1950s, then changed the name. And in the late 1980s, city voters approved a bond to protect and restore the cemetery.
With the bond issue, they came in, fixed the headstones, built the beautiful fence that you see around here.
It also helped begin a restoration and preservation effort. Among those notable Arizona pioneers, John Alsap, the first mayor of Phoenix, Daryl Dupa, who is credited with naming Phoenix and Tempe, and Jacob Waltz, You know, the man who discovered a gold mine in the Superstition Mountains and kept the location a secret. Many others are buried here.
It's around 3,600 burials that we know of. And there's only like 600 and some headstones. Many of the people that are buried, we know they're buried here, but in some cases, we don't even know the exact location of their burial.
In 2012, the remains of 14 people were unearthed during construction near the original cemetery site on 6th Avenue and Madison Street. Those remains were reinterred in Pioneer and Military Memorial Park nearly 100 years after it was closed. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And if you know things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Tejano music, which blends Mexican and American sounds, began in Texas, but it's grown far beyond its Lone Star roots. KJZZ's Stina Sieg recently spoke to one of its young stars who's playing the Valley this weekend.
AJ Castillo has this saying, if you want to play in Texas, you've got to have a squeeze box, as in accordion. It's usually a background thing, but this Austin-raised Tejano star brings it right to the forefront, playing as he sings. And Castillo says that's not all that sets him apart from others in his genre.
I listen to R&B, I listen to jazz, I listen to rock, I listen to country, and I take a little bit of every genre and put it into a blend, and that's my sound, AJ Castillo.
And he says he's helping infuse Tejano tunes with fresh energy.
That's what every genre needs. It needs its new fans, it needs young fans, it needs kids to follow and listen to the music and grow to love the music, and then they take over.
Melissa Santa Cruz can hear it happen. She's the program director and a DJ at Tejano 1600, a radio station down in Tucson. Santa Cruz grew up on this type of music, watched it flourish in the 90s, and then go through a lull more recently.
But I think artists, like these upcoming artists like AJ Castillo, the younger ones, the ones that are in their late 20s, maybe early to mid-30s, you know, I think that maybe they're just bringing like a new rebirth to it. Like, hey, you know, it's still going on. It's still here.
And Tejano is definitely not just a Texas thing. Castillo says there's something special about his fans outside the state, Arizona in particular.
It's hard to find a place you go somewhere where they bring you gifts and they know everything about you and they just respect everything about you, everything you've done, and it's just an incredible feeling, almost like family in Arizona.
Castillo and his squeeze box will play Wild Horse Pass in Chandler tonight. He'll be at Viquiva and Levine tomorrow night. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And Steve, a few things going on around the Valley this weekend. If you want to catch a movie in the park in Queen Creek, Fly Away Home is playing tomorrow at 7 about a flock of orphaned geese who are hopefully not as vicious as what we heard about in Stina's story.
And Nick, you and I are both sports fans. The Arizona Sports Fan Expo will be held this weekend, University of Phoenix Stadium, from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m.
The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our news director, Peter O'Dowd, and our executive producer is John Hoban.
And Nick Blumberg, thank you for co-hosting this week. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Have a great weekend. It is 3 o'clock.